This is 4:55 on Monday, September 19th.
Okay. So anybody here who did not get it back? Your name?
Number two, right?
What?
Number two.
Yeah.
Ellery?
What?
Ellery?
I don't have it.
Okay.
Did you turn it in?
Yeah.
Really? I did not see it. If you have a copy of it, you can email me.
Probably.
That would be good, because it didn't. I wonder where it went. Anybody else? Homework two. So, problem four, everybody did well on that. Just remember the URL. A couple things. The URL includes the host name as well as the path on the server, and the book is misleading about that, at least the slides are. So watch out for that. Second thing was, watch out for the instructions in the question. It asks you to say how you could tell certain things, and some people just gave the answer without referencing it to the provided material. Same thing with question five. The other thing that happened in question five was part D, the actual document being delivered by HTTP follows the pair of carriage return line feeds that end the headers. So we were looking for the thing that comes immediately after the headers, and that's the left bracket exclamation point DOC, rather than the things that are included later down in the HTML document. Problem 8 was the one that most people had the most trouble with. The issue, a number of issues. First of all, remember that when using a connection-oriented scheme, there's a round trip associated with making the connection, and before the first request can even be transmitted. So the minimum amount of time with a connection-oriented stream is two round trips for each connection that's made, because you make one round trip to establish the connection, and then you can send the first request and get the first response. So there's a factor of two missing in some of these. Second thing that tripped some people up was, remember that the way an HTML page works is you've got the HTML page, and within the page you have references to these objects. They said there were 8 objects referenced from the page. The page itself is going to take a round trip. So there are 9 things to be retrieved, not 8 in this problem. Okay, so that was that. Parallel connections, I think mostly people were tripped up by the not taking into account either the factor of two or the fact that there's the HTML page, which has to be retrieved first before you can retrieve the objects that it references. So you know, you can't amortize the whole nine objects over the multiple connections. You have to make a round trip to get two round trips to get the page, and then you can start fetching the pages in parallel. So it's going to take you 6 round trips in that case. Yes, 6. Michael.
Oh, I had a question about C.
Okay, I haven't got to C yet. Okay, so part C asks about persistent, using persistent HTTP connection instead. So let's think about that. It takes two round trips to get the page initially, right? Just like it always does for any new connection. Two round trips to get the page initially, and then you can make all of the eight contained objects. You can request all of the contained eight objects just one right after the other. Okay?
So those are separate, or are those all together?
They're separate requests at the HTTP level, but at the stream level, they're just one right after the other. There's no waiting involved between them.
But wouldn't there still be a round trip between requesting and receiving it?
Oh, yes, definitely. So it's two round trips to get the page initially,
yeah,
and then a third round trip to get all of the content.
Well, so it wouldn't be a round trip between each of them?
No. No, because I need to draw a picture, and I'm not set up to draw today because Jack had my cable. Here.
I'm imagining it's going up, 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 and then down, 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 down.
Yeah, that picture in the book like that, kind of like a bunch of requests after the connection is made, and then a bunch of requests.
Right. So all of the requests, because we're ignoring the transmission time, all eight requests go essentially at once. And all eight replies come essentially at once.
Wouldn't that be parallel connection then almost?
No. Parallel connections is when you have separate TCP connections, but you're using multiple TCP connections. So in the parallel, I really need to draw. I can't handle this.
So they're just, when you send each request, they're so close to each other, it's almost instant.
Yes. I mean, the sending is so much shorter than the round trip time that it can be more
so
or less.
The total time for that would be three. Then?
Would be three. Yeah. Am I going to draw, or have we seen it?
Yeah. That makes sense more
now. Others, do I need to draw this? There is, as Riley said, there is a picture in the book. So, you look at that. Leave it. I'm using yours. That's why I can't find it. That's all right. Okay, so that was the one that was hardest, I would say, on this assignment. Problem 18, the point there was mostly to just have you try out some tools and look around and sort of explain. And as somebody said, I don't understand everything I'm seeing here. That's okay, right? We haven't really talked about all the internet addressing and stuff, so that's fine. But at least you got some experience with the tools. I think I asked who is the authoritative source for the RFC docs. It's the Internet Engineering Task Force, or the RFC editor. Not the W3 Consortium. W3 Consortium has taken over the specifications of things like HTML and a bunch of other specifications that are involved in the Internet, but they're no longer RFCs. Well, the RFCs still exist. The governing standard has moved beyond. Okay.
And RFC just stands for Request for Comments.
It stands for Request for Comments, but in fact, the ones that have made it to standards level are still called RFCs. There's no more comments wanted, but they are. Okay. Does it, that's what it sounds? Yeah. Well, stands for it, but here we go. Yeah. Pass those back to Brooke, and I'm sorry. Need to refresh your name. Yeah, Derek. So any more questions about that? Expect a P8-like problem on the exam. Today we're going to start talking about, before we start talking about transport layer, any questions about the programming problem? Programming assignment. No? Yes?
I guess it's not really a question. Well, it is a question, but when I'm building this, I have like it connecting together, and then should I just have sort of like separate functions for each piece of what I'm doing? Or should I just have it all in like one main?
You should have two main programs. You should have a main and two files, one for the server and one for the client.
And then it should kind of just go through the steps of the. By steps, I mean like this.
So you're asking should you use sort of good program design techniques to implement each of the client and server?
Yeah, well, I'm just saying I should probably have something to get the strings from the client at first, but then should I have something to like retrieve or?
Well, yes, you're going to have something. The question is, what is that something? Are you asking, should you put it in a separate procedure or a function? It would probably be a good idea, just for sanity's sake, yours and mine. But that's a question about sort of program design that should be getting ingrained now, and I shouldn't have to talk about in this class.
Of course.
Okay.
They
kind of string it all. Well, so the program in the book does one very simple thing, right? It receives a message and sends it back. This one's more complicated. Your assignment is more complicated. So I think breaking it down into separate procedures and functions would be helpful to you and to me.
Okay.
I think the main should just be a sequence of calls to separate functions that do the steps, but that's up to you. Somebody also asked the question, so I've written some socket connection code for 360, can I reuse that? And sure. This dance of making socket connections is so standardized that there's nothing really creative involved in it. So one of the things that programmers do is they reuse the code that worked before to avoid making new mistakes, and that's a good thing. So feel free. The actual assignment here is different. The behavior once the connections are established is different, so you'll have to do that separately. All right. So we're going to start talking about the transport layer. Transport layer, where does it fit in the sequence of layers? What layers is it between?
The network layer and the application?
Yeah, between the network layer and the application layer. At the application layer, we've talked about application layer protocols having to do with, you know, what is the exact sequence of bytes on a stream or in a packet in order to accomplish a particular task, like the HTTP protocol, the mail protocol, and so forth. So to understand the transport layer, what we have to understand is sort of what are the gaps. Essentially, the transport layer fills in the gap between the network layer and the application. And the gap comes in the form of what's missing at the network layer that needs to be done to help out the transport layer, to help out the application layer. So those services are, at the most basic level, multiplexing and demultiplexing. Remember, and we'll see this in a second, the network layer's job is to get the packets from the source host to the destination host. And it's up to the transport layer to get it to the application. In the internet, the network layer does not provide reliable data transfer, and that's something that we've seen we need at the application layer. The network layer does not provide flow control. It doesn't provide any way for the receiver of messages to say to the sender, you're going too fast. You're going faster than I can keep up with. So you got to slow down. So that's a function that appears in some kinds of transport layers. And finally, surprisingly enough, the network layer itself is vulnerable to the problem of too many senders sending too much data to it. And in the internet, at least, it is the job of the transport layer to address that problem. That's a little bit weird. Other underlying network technologies put the congestion control at the network layer.
Yeah.
Okay. They seem very similar. So that's an excellent question. Flow control is about the receiver telling the sender to slow down. Okay? Congestion control is about the network somehow telling the senders to slow down because the network is being overloaded. The destination host, the obvious thing is that the destination host can do the flow control interaction with the sender. The congestion control is really kind of a hack because the internet network layer doesn't have any congestion control in it. And so they put it at the transport layer. And therefore, it works more or less well, instead of well. Wrong buttons. Okay, so we've talked about this before. UDP is connectionless, TCP is connection-oriented, and TCP also does congestion control, which UDP does not, and that's a problem. Okay. So the transport layer overall goal is communication between processes running on different hosts. The terminology here is, we've used the word packet sort of generically to talk about what is sent over the internet. The more proper terminology is that at the transport layer we talk about segments, at the network layer we talk about datagrams. Okay, so the transport layer breaks messages into segments and passes them to the network layer that sticks them into datagrams and then sends them on downward to the physical layer. The receive side has to put the messages back and pass them to the application layer, and you can use... Okay, so TCP and UDP are the primary transport layers in the internet. There's also others. There's something called the SCTP, the Stream Control Transfer Protocol or something like that, that tries to have some of the best features and characteristics of both TCP and UDP. But it doesn't get used a whole lot yet. We'll see if that changes as new applications come along. Okay. So, at the transport layer, we're talking end-to-end between processes, network layer between hosts, said all that.
Are you recording?
Of course. Yes.
I'm sorry I did this wrong. One button and you're in trouble.
Yeah, Levi.
Is it fair to say that the transport layer is implemented entirely in software? It's just an abstraction to define a certain number of tasks. It's not actually describing like any part of the physical network, right?
Right, exactly. And indeed, the network layer is as well. The network layer is sort of completely above the link layer and the physical layer, where you really end up with physical considerations.
So this is actually accomplished by computers and not special machinery and so forth.
Right, right. So what you see here in the picture is that there's all this stuff sort of underneath that just sort of disappears from the view here. The only implementation of transport layer is in the end host. At the network layer, there's end host stuff and stuff in the middle, but only in the end host for the transport layer.
Basically, that's because it goes to the network and then it doesn't care about how it gets there, and then when it gets there, it goes back in the transport layer, so it's as if it was just straight there.
Right, yeah. So you pass it down to the network layer. The network layer sort of interacts with the next thing along the way as the packet goes, all at the network layer, and eventually it pops out again out of the network layer and back into the transport layer at the end. Okay, we've said most of this before. TCP provides reliable in-order delivery of streams of bytes without worrying about message boundaries. UDP is essentially little more than just IP plus a port number for demultiplexing. Neither of these produces any form of delay guarantee or bandwidth guarantee. It's still best effort service. Okay. Multiplexing and demultiplexing. So the double E's are probably very familiar with the idea of multiplexing, right? Yeah. The idea of using one thing for multiple purposes. And at the in networking, the multiplexing at this level is the sharing of a single IP address among multiple applications. And the way you do that, we talked about in chapter 2, is you use these port numbers, right? So you have a host address and a port number, and together they identify an application. Okay. So the way it works is you're getting these IP datagrams, and as part of the network layer, we have to include the host IP address, right? As part of the network layer datagram, because everybody along the way has to know where the message is going in order to get it to its final destination, as far as the network layer is concerned. Then it arrives at the host, and within that IP datagram, you find a transport layer segment, and the transport layer segment then contains a header that says where it came from, as far as a port number is concerned, and where it's going, another port number. So source port and destination port. And that's it. That's how you figure out where it's going. That's enough information to figure out where it's going. The exact way that the IP addresses and the port numbers are used for demultiplexing depends on whether you're using TCP or UDP. Okay. So, in UDP, and sorry, these are Java-ish socket calls rather than C-ish ones. You see how much nicer it is in the newer languages than what we dealt with in C. You create a socket. This is like the socket system call, passing datagram kinds of sockets, with a port number, and then your socket is associated with that port number, for both for the purpose of receiving, so when you receive a message addressed to that port, it comes to you, and for the purpose of sending. When you use that port to send, the source port is that socket number as well. Okay? So when you receive a UDP segment, what happens, the operating system implementation of networking pulls out that that transport layer segment, looks in the header, and says, what is the destination port? The destination port. That's all it looks at. And it has a table that says that destination port is associated with a particular socket. And so that's how it knows where it's going to go. So with UDP, the IP addresses, the network layer addresses, don't enter into this picture at all. Just the port numbers. And these pictures are in the book. I suggest you just look at them. SP and DP here stand for source port and destination port, if it's not obvious, but you can just look at that. All right. For TCP, the story is a little different. For TCP, because we have a connection, we can be a little less profligate with port numbers. So for TCP, you think of the thing to be identified at both the source and the destination as a particular connection, right? TCP is connection-oriented, so when you're sending or receiving, there's a connection associated with that that is set up by the TCP startup code. And so what identifies a TCP connection? Well, both IP addresses and both port numbers. So the four tuple, consisting of those four things, is what it is that makes up the identity of a particular connection. And so if you change the destination IP address, you have a different connection. If you change the destination port number, it's a different connection. And TCP oriented applications make good use of this to avoid having to have lots of ports. So each socket here is identified essentially by its own four tuple. Things are a little different for the sockets on which we listen and accept. They don't have any destination IP and port number, right? Because when you have, remember the socket dance for connection oriented TCP. It's socket, bind, listen, accept, right? And you've never said anything about who you're talking to in that picture. It's just my own port number essentially, and any local IP address. But then once somebody shows up to make a connection to that listening socket, then I do know both my address and port number for the, my address and port number. It's the same port number locally. But I also know his destination address and his, I also know his IP address and port number. And together now we have all four things, and that makes up one connection. Okay. And that will be associated with a single socket. So again, the same picture. Yeah, okay, this is kind of cool. So this one's worth looking at. So here we have, this is a web client, a web server. We'll look at what's going on here. Process 2 here is using one source port, and process 3 is using a different source port, and that's enough to distinguish between this socket and this socket on this end, and between this socket and this socket on this end, as far as any traffic going back and forth between them. Am I just belaboring this too much, or is this okay? I feel like I may be belaboring it too much, but on the other hand, it's important, so I'll go on and yell if it's too soon. All right, so that's the addressing side of things. Let's talk about UDP. There's not a whole lot to say about UDP. So let's think about the consequences of UDP being a very thin shim over basic IP datagrams. You launch a datagram into the internet. What happens to it? Well, it bounces around between different places called routers. We haven't talked about the network layer yet. We can't say too much about that. But the goal of those routers is to keep forwarding that message toward its destination. Unfortunately, the network, the internet network of routers is not a single path between you and wherever that packet is going, but rather it's a network of routers. It's a mesh. And so when you launch a packet into the internet, the first packet may go one path, second packet may go a different path. And as a result of that, the two packets may actually arrive in a different order than you sent them. Well, if you're a UDP using application, you have to be prepared for that to happen. The other thing that can happen is that the network does absolutely no work to make sure that that packet that you launched into it actually gets delivered. It's perfectly entitled to say, no, that one's too much work for me right now, so gone. That's the rules of the way the internet is built. Of course, if the internet does that too often, it's not working very well and people will complain, but any given packet is not worth anything to the internet. The other thing is that you can just launch, if you know an IP destination address, you can just launch a packet into the network. You don't have to do anything at all ahead of time. It will either get where it's going or it won't. And that's what the service that UDP provides. It's amazing that it works. So why is it good? Well, we talked about in the applications chapter and the problem, we talked about how you can't do any useful work with TCP until you've waited essentially two round trip times. That's maybe more than you want to wait, Maybe you want to tell something to somebody fast, something to somebody fast. UDP is good for that. You can send them something and, you know, with high probability they'll get it, and maybe they won't. It's easy to implement something like UDP. We're going to see what it takes to implement the connection-oriented protocols. It's hairy. It is not well understood by almost any programmers in the world. There are probably, you know, 10,000, but that's a very small fraction of the number of programmers in the world these days, so hardly any. It's hard to get right. Any number of TCP implementations are broken and stay that way for many years, gradually evolving into something that works. There's a significant amount of additional data that has to be passed in every datagram in order to manage the connection-oriented nature. So it wastes bandwidth to a certain extent. Less and less of a problem as network speeds have increased. And then there's this no congestion control thing, which is, well, if you're writing a particular UDP application, you want to use a lot of bandwidth and steal it away from everybody else. That's a virtue, but it's overall, in the grand scheme of things, not a virtue that applications can be very rude to everybody else on the network. And yeah, it's a tragedy of the commons sort of thing. Do people know the story of the tragedy of the commons? Yes? No? Yeah. So the tragedy of the commons, and I don't know who pointed this out, but it goes back a long, long time. It concerns what happens when a whole bunch of families have the right to graze their sheep or cattle on the same piece of ground. And what happens is that in optimizing their own family performance, what the goal will become is everybody will try to have more sheep, say. And people will just pour sheep onto the common ground until they overgraze it and all the sheep die. But there's nothing that sort of drives them away from that behavior in a local kind of context. So that's the tragedy. It's called tragedy of the commons because the commons is actually the common pasture ground that the sheep graze upon. Whereas if you know the family owned its own pasture, it would see that the sheep were dying and take some sheep off the ground. You know, and then they would sort of find the point where the sheep thrived and made the most meat or milk or wool or whatever it is. Okay, we talked about what kinds of applications would like to have a UDP-like service. If you want reliability over UDP, you have to implement it at the application layer. It provides no help. And you know, the same kind of part of the reason for learning about the implementation of TCP, which we'll do in a bit, is that you may want to use some of those TCP-like techniques in your UDP applications to improve reliability. That's one reason for learning that. Okay, so the header is the source port and destination port that we looked at before. A length and the checksum. So the idea of the checksum is to identify if the message has been corrupted in transfer. Levi?
The application-specific error recovery, does that mean actually requesting another packet?
Mm-hmm.
Or, okay, I didn't know if you meant from some kind of like
ESP
stuff where you reconstruct.
Well, you could do it that way too, right? It's sort of up to you what you do. The point is that there's none here. You can do what you want, but there's nothing here to help. We're going to talk about checksums. The idea of checksums. And again, this is something that I suspect never actually does anything useful in practice these days. But here's the idea. Suppose you're sending a bunch of data to somebody, and you want to know whether the data was corrupted in transit. Well, if the only thing you send him is the data, how is he going to know whether something was corrupted in traffic in transit? He has no way to tell. So, to give him a handle on a way to tell, you include something called redundancy. That is a little bit of additional information that he can use to tell whether it sort of repeats something about what was sent. And the UDP checksum scheme is very simple. You send 16 bits of that's formed by essentially adding up all the 16-bit words that make up the message and send that along with it. So this sum. So that's why it's called a checksum. It's not exactly addition, but close enough. So you add them all up, and you put that into the checksum field, and when the receiver gets the message, he adds up all the bytes of the message and says, does it equal? Okay? And it's a very simple little check. It's not a very good check, because you're only sending 16 bits of redundant for a message that may be 64 kilobytes long, which is, you can't, we'll get to the theory of this, but you can't distinguish between 2 to the 64 kilobytes different values with just a 16-bit value. It doesn't work. So there are lots of possibilities for errors that you can't detect. But nevertheless, we do this. The other reason that this seems kind of silly these days is that the link layer protocols that we use have much better error checking. So corruption at the link layer is extremely rare, and if it occurs, the packet is thrown away anyway. And the memories that we have these days in the intermediate stages along the way through the network are also much more reliable than they were back when UDP was designed. So my guess is, although I've not ever seen anybody report on this, that if you look in the statistics for a operating system, I think you can get it out of the procnet fields in Linux, for example, you can find out sort of how often these checksums are detecting an error, and I suspect you will find that it is almost zero because of all the other checks that are happening first. Yeah.
Is it impossible for the checksum to be corrupted and then have a false corruption?
Oh, sure. One of the things that may happen is that the checksum itself gets corrupted, and then you throw away the packet. So the response to a bad checksum is you just throw away the packet. Okay, that it's just another source of the packets getting thrown away. and the rest of the system is all prepared to deal with that. So that's fine. And that's often what we'll see. So that's another thing we're saying. So another thing that engineers like to talk about is sort of coding theory and how to sort of embed redundancy sort of directly in the signals that are on the wires, right? And you go to sort of all kinds of different schemes for doing that and sticking in extra bits along the way and so on and so forth. And that's all very applicable and used at the link layer in IP networking, at the link layer and the physical layer below. Above the link layer, the sort of only thing we typically do is some sort of checksum that, if violated, causes the packet to be treated as dropped. Okay. We don't do anything fancier than that. because we have all the mechanisms in place to deal with packets being dropped, and packets get dropped for other reasons much more frequently than they get dropped for this reason, so why bother? there's very much a flavor in the internet of design choices that were made because somebody else is doing all the work that's needed that turns it into say a dropped packet, and we know how to deal with dropped packets. So just, which reminds, we're almost done, so I'll tell you a story. So when I took circuits from Dr. Dick Baker here at WSU in 1972, this is a story he told me. So he said, how do you tell the difference between you give the following problem to a engineer, and you give it to a mathematician, and the problem is there's a bucket of water sitting on the floor, and the problem you give them is to put it on the table. Okay, so they each come along and So there's a bucket of water sitting on a chair, and you tell them to put it on the table. So you tell the engineer to do this, and he picks up the bucket of water and he puts it on the table. And you tell the mathematician to do this, and he picks up the bucket and puts it on the table. And then you put the bucket of the water on the floor, and you ask them to do the same thing, and the engineer picks up the bucket of water and puts it on the table, and the mathematician picks it up and puts it on the chair, and he says, I've reduced it to the previous case. Well, there's, surprisingly, in internet engineering, there's a lot of that mathematician sort of behavior going on. We reduce things to the previous case quite a lot, and checksums is one of those. Anyway, I enjoyed it at the time, and I think it's still fun to share. So next time we will go on and talk about TCP in detail, which is a lot more complicated.